We know when to go out, we know when to stay in. But it's mostly staying in these days, to be honest with you. Hello, and welcome to this week's Big Mouth, the cyclotron of music, film and TV, where we put the latest records, shows, reissues and movies into a centrifuge and then examine what's left of them. My name's Andrew Harrison, and this week we will be reducing the following to their constituent particles. Morrissey's new album, Low in High School. How are things with the 58-year-old teenager, and is he still in detention for unhelpful comments in class? Sky TV's new Sunday night bacchanal, Babylon Berlin, a co-production with Sky Deutschland set in the debauched demimonde of 1920s Germany. And we'll be looking at reissues of Queen's punk-denying 1977 big rock opus News of the World, and the almost contemporaneous soundtrack to Saturday Night Fever, as well as hearing the tunes that our guests love right now, in which case, we better meet those guests. Pete Brown is an award-winning beer writer and the author of books including A Man Walks Into a Pub, Shakespeare's Local, and now Miracle Brew, Hops, Barley, Water, Yeast, and the Nature of Beer. Before that, he worked in advertising, where he persuaded Heineken to drop its slogan, Heineken refreshes the parts other beers cannot reach, right before it was named the most successful advertising slogan of all time. Excellent work, Pete. He's also a music fiend. He loves New Order, Elbow, and all proper emotional man music. And he keeps telling me he wishes he'd become a music journalist, not noticing that I am staring enviously at his house full of free beer. Hello, Pete.
Hello.
How are you doing?
I'm very good, thank you.
Does a fondness for beer lead you towards the more lacrimose, sentimental end of the New Order catalogue, do you think?
I think so, definitely. You know, beer tracks all your moods, but they all inevitably end up late at night, sitting in front of old Top of the Pops reruns, lamenting your lost youth. Over a nice Imperial Porter or Belgian quadruple.
I'm going to hammer this one ruthlessly throughout the show. If New Order and Joy Division were beers, what beers would they be?
Well, Joy Division's very easy. I actually use that in my beer and music matching presentation that I do. Unknown Pleasures was recorded in Strawberry Studios in Stockport, as we all know. Mm-hmm. The best thing to ever come out of Stockport, the second best thing to come out of Stockport, is Old Tom by Robinson's, which is a 100-year-old recipe for an old ale, which is dark, mysterious, industrial, thick, complex, just like the album. So they go together perfectly. New Order, for me, the lovely bright synths on albums like Power, Corruption and Lies, for me, pick out... top notes in American hops. So a big West Coast IPA with all the kind of grapefruit and citrusy flavours. And then the bitterness underneath.
The bitterness underneath.
That just kind of pairs it perfectly. Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
Also, surely the best thing to come out of Stockport was when Carlton Palmer got sacked off from Stockport County, because he was taking that team out of the league, actually, he did.
The best thing to come out of Stockport is, of course, Christopher Eccleston. Also with us, we have film journalist Linda Marek. She writes for Hey You Guys, The Jewish Chronicle, and ScreenWords.co.uk, and we're happy to report that she's consistently right about everything from Thor Ragnarok to the artiest latest French indie release. Hello, Linda. How are you today?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Now, I'm all right, not bad. So film critics, like music writers, often suffer from the seen too much syndrome. You know, you're barraged with so much stuff.
Exactly.
And you just don't get what Joe Public wants. You know, you can't find it in your heart to give Ed Sheeran a good review. How do you keep that at bay? As a film-buried lady.
In all honesty, I just review things whether I enjoy them or not. I never really look at what other people think of them. So I have to be honest with myself. If I don't like a film, even if it gets five-star reviews from other people, I don't like it, and that's that, you know? Like, for example... the latest Kenneth Branagh movie, which
Murder on the Orient Express.
Yeah, which I absolutely hated. And I know some people really liked it, and I absolutely hate it. I thought it was boring, just had nothing going for it. I just thought it was an expensive mess.
One star, big mouth. So we're nearly at Christmas, which means that most of the kind of big budget things have kind of been and gone. What should we be looking at between now and Christmas? What's good? What's good coming up?
You've got Paddington 2, which is brilliant, I absolutely loved, and to which I gave 5 stars.
Excellent.
And,
looking forward to that.
What else? Battle of the Sexes.
Which is that?
Which is the Billie Jean King film. What else? The Killing of Sacred Deer, which is brilliant.
That is really terrifying in the trailers.
That's a fantastic movie.
This is a revenge film within a kind of a sort of Lars von Trier art context.
Yeah, it's from the same director who did The Lobster, so you know what you get in, that kind of deadpan sort of, you know, quite...
I think I'll be holding out for The Last Jedi.
No, it's a great movie. It's a really good movie.
Also with us, completing the team, is the man who keeps the show appropriately framed and lit and banishes all hairs from the gate. It's our producer, the Erwin Thalberger Podcasts, in his jodhpurs with his megaphone. It's Matt Hall. Hello, Matt. How are you doing?
And the monocle.
And the
Don't
monocle.
Don't forget the monocle.
Do the podcast again, but better. Do you ever wish you'd foregone a lucrative career in radio to be, I don't know, reviewing beers and films, Matt?
I don't know, you know, because I just get a simple pleasure from both of those things. And if I had to kind of sit there and analyse it, much the same way as music has stopped being pleasurable for me.
You're listening to Big Mouth, where we hate music and film. Okay, before we get started, a couple of gentle reminders. If you're enjoying Big Mouth, then please do subscribe via Apple Podcasts and leave us a nice review and a star rating if you can. It helps us to get new listeners, and we would very much appreciate it. Also, you might enjoy our partner show, Remaniacs, the no-bullshit Brexit podcast, with Big Mouth regular Dorian Linsky, plus special guests on the collapsing clown car that is Brexit. You can find Remaniacs on Apple Podcasts too, plus all the main platforms, including Spotify. Links are at remaniacs.com. Okay, who wants to have a massive big argument? Morrissey releases his first studio album since 2014 next week. Low in High School was trailed by the unusually sprightly single Spent the Day in Bed, which promised final liberation from the standard guitar format he's been hammering for years. Could this be a whole new Morrissey before us? Of course, then he has to go and spoil it all by praising the noxious extremist Anne-Marie Waters, failed candidate for the UKIP leadership. And at the same time, an old piece of merchandise displaying a Union Jack made out of flick knives with rather unnerving gothic type has surfaced from his online store. So are we following the art or the artists? And whether the actions of the latter overwhelm the former? We're going to talk about that and the album after this track. This is I Wish You Lonely. Morrissey with I Wish You Lonely from Low in High School, out next week. Now, Pete Brown, I promised I was going to do this. I'm going to start as a mean go on. As a mean to go on. If Morrissey were a beer, what beer would Morrissey be?
Oh, definitely bitter.
I mean, any particular
what
bitter?
Else?
Yes, something that's kind of... No, I mean, it's too obvious. The thing is, musically, it's quite diverse. You know, I was trying to match up beers. There's a formula for matching basic tastes and musical styles. Mm. So sweetness is high-pitched and harmonious, bitterness is low and sonorous. Mm. And so different songs can pick up different elements from beers. And this is, musically, this is quite all over the map. So it's bitterness is an easy joke, but there's quite a lot of stuff that could go with this. I'm thinking dark complex beers.
Dark complex beers, because beer is not vegetarian, is it? It's got fish bladder in it.
Well, Guinness now does vegetarian beers.
Guinness vegan.
Yeah, they've taken the fish bladders out.
Really?
Yeah, and there's a few beers following suit now.
It's a big splash. Now with no fish bladders.
Now with no chopped up swim bladders of sturgeons.
Lovely. Have you been a Morrissey follower in the past?
I mean, I was of that generation where the Smiths just completely changed my life. Sitting in my bedroom with my little hi-fi system and, you know, the whole story that everyone's heard 1,000 times of just going, this man speaking to me is telling my story. I loved the first solo album up to that point, and then just drifted away in the early 90s.
Yeah.
So, and then like anyone from my generation, just watching with increasing sadness and dismay.
Yes.
As he's pioneered his new course.
Yes. What did you make of this one?
It was interesting. I thought at the start it was so bad. I was kind of hoping that Morrissey was doing some kind of meta concept of playing a character called Morrissey, or maybe Ziggy Farage and the Spice from us. Because the first track is like, oh, you can't believe the media, the lies it tells, oh, we're not allowed to say anything anymore.
And it's just like gone mad.
It's like a Daily Mail comments column. And I was despairing, shaking my head, and then got to the middle, and the sixth track, I Bury the Living, I think it's one of the best things he's ever done.
I was really moved by it. Yeah.
And it was inventive. And to me, that track felt like the first one on the album that was him actually working with musicians.
Yeah.
As opposed to him writing some screed and then forcing some session musos to kind of put a backing track to it.
Yeah. Linda, you've had a bit of a checkered relationship with Morrissey.
I have been a hardcore Morrissey fan for a very long time. And like Pete, I was actually more of a Morrissey fan than a Smiths fan. I got into him, I think, early 90s, perhaps 1991, and had been a fan for almost 20 years, I'd say. Yeah. And fell out of love with him because of...
For numerous reasons.
reasons. But I actually like this album. To be honest, I don't think he's done anything good since You Are the Quarry, and that was 2004, I think.
Right, yeah.
And this reminded me very much of his earlier stuff, like Your Arsenal, Vauxhall and I. I just thought it had that kind of... the same kind of rockabilly sound. Those beautiful albums had...
There's a lot of glam on it, isn't there? Particularly the first track.
Yeah.
What's the first track called?
My Love, which is...
That's the one that's banging on about the mainstream media, but it does sound... It's got glam rock wallop. What is it with all these old fellas like Morrissey and Noel Gallagher getting the Slade out again and the glam rock? You
know? I think with Morrissey, the problem was that lots of his hardcore fans didn't really like all his... American sounding albums, from You Are the Quarry onwards. I'm not a fan of his American band. I really like all the stuff he did with Boz Bura, Alan White, Gary, when Gary was his bassist. I really liked that kind of that London sound, the sort of rocking.
Ted's basically.
The rocking sound, the sort of rockabilly sound. And I think he's trying to get back to that. And I mean, if we forget the horrid lyrics, which are just ridiculous Daily Mail stuff.
It is old man maundering, a lot of it, isn't it?
If we ignore all of that, I kind of like this sound. It reminds me of the old Morrissey.
Well, actually, I was going to say the opposite, because I actually do really like his new band. And since he... Is it Gustav Manzo, the new musical that writes a lot of the songs? Yeah. I think that's kind of brought a bit more musical colour to the palette. You know, you're getting keyboards, you're getting picked guitars and all these things.
You get like a Latin sound.
Yeah, you get
Latin sound.
That was... that is quite a strange... Is it the girl from Tel Aviv?
It's kind of bossa nova, klezmer kind of thing going on.
It's quite lightweight klezmer though, isn't it? You really want to wade in with a horn. This is probably like Tel Aviv Magic FM. Taxi Drivers of Tel Aviv. What I find funny about it is that like all of his songs now kind of gravitate to the same thing. He'll start off talking about, police violence or oppression in a particular country or the lives of the media, and it'll all gravitate back to his sex life. So the solution is that everybody should have sex with me, Morrissey, is the solution to the world problems. And of course, there's a great situationist argument for that. Nothing's more revolutionary than random sex with random people. But it does kind of give you the sense that now the songs don't necessarily all sound the same anymore, but they're kind of all saying the same thing.
I think he's also plagiarising himself from early on. I think he's suddenly just thought, I really do think so. I mean, the first song on the album sounds like Glamorous Glue. I don't know if you know, from Your Arsenal. It really sounds... I actually played them side by side, and it just sounded very much...
But I think this track is more insane than Glamorous Glue, because it's got all these sort of nervous breakdown horns and random instrumentation, which really makes it quite exciting, I think. There are some genuinely unintentionally funny bits on it, though. There's a track called All the Young People Must Fall in Love, and the opening lines are, spend more on nuclear war, if that's your illusion. It sounds like something from A Mighty Wind.
Talking of films from that stable, is it just me that on the track In Your Lap, the thing that it most reminded me of was Nigel Tufnell's unfinished masterpiece, the sonorous piano, the lovely kind of like...
Yes.
It's like Lick Your Love Pump. So, kind of like, yes. It kind of comes in as a kind of yes. I want my face in your lap.
We start off talking about the Arab Spring and finish up with what Morrissey has a bit of filth in his life.
Yes, the dictators have tried to exterminate us and let's have oral sex.
Well, you know, there are worse solutions to these things. To me, though, it is the blot on the whole thing is that he's managing his worldview and his political statements managed to combine the kind of callow teenager with the miserable old pensioner at the same time. The world's going to the dogs and you can't trust anyone and it's so unfair.
Sounds like an angry old Brexiter, really. I mean, he doesn't really...
Which song is it? We're heading for the exit. Which exit are we talking about, Morrissey? And then it finishes off with children laughing.
I actually think that's one of the most exciting parts of the record. That's what is Jackie's Only Happy When She's On Stage.
Yes, that's right.
Jackie's Only Happy When She's Off the Stage. It finishes. It again. It's a song with a departure point of a performer that then just wanders off into Morrissey's kind of obsessions and fears and ends up with this kind of fire in a theatre idea. I thought it was really exciting.
But that point about his teenage self and the old man, there are points when it feels like his modern worldview actually does link up with the bedroom-bound teenager of the Smiths, that he just has never grown up from that, and so it kind of ossifies into this kind of disdain of the world, and it's every teenager feels like that, but you shouldn't still be feeling that when you're 58.
I think it's quite interesting. He's always thought about and talked about his own death, and of course now it's
a bit closer than it was.
And so you kind of think there's actually a kind of a sadness that you never got before. Before he was just being overly dramatic and teenage and like, oh, I want to die.
I'm not long for this
and
world.
Now it's like, well, you know what? It's probably 20 years at the outset, you know. But I did wonder why you still, even though the kind of lyrical concerns are still, you know, they're just kind of like really nuts, as Pete said, like a kind of Daily Mail kind of comment section. But you've got to give marks to the man who uses the word oligarch, not in one song, but in two songs, you know, and it's just like, no, who else would do that?
Yeah. Well, it is a bit like this. It's like somebody singing Canary editorials as well as David Mail. You know? I always find it like odd that, you know, he's kind of embracing these kind of, you know, sort of reactionary, grumpy old man politics and a very sort of very macho, you know, Mexican Hispanic fan base. It's been the wellspring of his popularity over the past decade. And this working class macho flick knife thing. It's all very, very male. And it's not very now, because now is all trans and crossing barriers and being intersex and all the rest of it, what young Morrissey would have been into. And I wonder what young Morrissey would think about this kind of, you know, chunky uncle moaning on about immigrants. What would young Morrissey think about modern Morrissey?
He wouldn't like him, surely. No. You've got to think that's he kind of turned into something that he was scared of. I would imagine. Because I think you're absolutely right. If Morrissey was 20 now, he would totally be into all the kind of modern sexual politics. That's what would be defining him now.
Yeah.
If he was that age now. And I can't imagine that Morrissey, as he is now, has got much time for that.
I think he needs to reconnect with young Morrissey, paint his fingernails, and get a frock on.
Yes.
Is what we need from Morrissey. Anyway, but I really did enjoy this album. I think it's the best Morrissey album in a long time.
Yeah, I agree.
And again, Art Trump's Artist. There we are. Shall we move on to some different pop music? Mm-hmm. Every week we ask our guests to bring in something to play to you, the beloved listener, a tune they love and they want to press on to you. Their own personal editor's recommendation, if you like. Linda Marek, what have you brought for us?
I brought the new song by Sufjan Stevens, which is called
Mystery of Love.
Which features very heavily in the new film Call Me by Your Name, which is possibly my favourite film of the year. But we'll talk more about that after we listen to the song, I guess.
So, here we go, Mystery of Love, Sufjan Stevens.
Oh, to see without my eyes the first time that you kissed me, boundless by the time I cried. I built your walls around me, a white noise, what an awful sound. Fumbling by
Mystery of Love by Sufjan Stevens, as chosen by Linda Marek, and it's from the soundtrack to
Call Me By Your Name.
Which is lovely because?
Because it is one of the most beautifully shot movies, and just a lovely story about sort of finding love for the first time. And it's a gay love story, but it's not just about that. It's about sort of discovering who you are and feeling sort of when you fall in love for the first time in your life and how you interact with the person you're falling in love with. And I just think it's just the most beautifully shot movie of the year, beautifully acted by a young actor called Timothée Chalamet and Armie Hammer, who is surprisingly brilliant in this movie. Absolutely beautiful.
You mean a more subtle performance than The Man from U.N.C.L.E., are you telling me this?
He is just incredible in this film. He's such a great actor.
Also, it takes place in sunny France in the middle of summer.
Oh, it's Italy.
Italy, yeah, so sunny Italy.
Lombardy.
Yeah, which is, I suppose, nice to think.
Which is kind of the between France and Italy.
Yeah,
and
it's nice to watch in November then.
Gorgeous, gorgeous film. And I really genuinely hope that it will win the best picture at the Oscars, but
who knows?
See.
Okay, moving on. let's face it, there aren't nearly enough perfectly realised multi-stranded immersive TV epics these days. Hence Babylon Berlin, a new co-production between British and German Sky TV, which depicts the political, social and sexual tumult of Weimar Germany. Economic turbulence, the rise of the far right, total mistrust of government, new sexual identities and widespread corruption. What could it possibly have to say to us today? Here's a taste of the flavour, if not the dialogue, because it's all in German. Babylon Berlin on Sky Atlantic, the most expensive German show ever made, apparently. Mm-hmm. Linda Marek, this is Interwar Germany at its seediest. What did you think?
I really liked it. Liked it a lot. I just wish it had been a bit more subversive than that. Mm. I thought it was cleaner than I expected it to be. You think of Berlin in the 20s, you expect it to be a bit more sort of seedy, I thought it was very expositional, the first episode, or that's to be expected, I guess. But other than that, I thought it was really, really well done.
It does actually get massively seedy later on.
Oh, good.
On.
I want it to be.
There's brothels.
Yeah. S&M, please bring it on.
The gist of it is that, you know, we're in a Berlin that's... the whole thing is conditioned by the trauma of the First World War, not just the physical injury, but the mental humiliation of
PTSD.
Everyone's got PTSD. The lead character, Rath, the vice cop, is a trembler. His hand wobbles at the sight of any sharp sound. What I really liked about it initially was that I wasn't really sure where I was. There were no kind of pointers to tell me what I was watching, but it does develop very quickly into there is an incriminating film of someone high up which must be found. And to discover this, we go into the filthy underworld of Weimar Germany and we see how wonderful and dreadful it is. Mm. Pete, what did you think?
Yeah, for me, what I loved about it most was when you get period drama, quite often you're constantly reminded how different that period is from where we are now. And for me, truly excellent. I've only really thought about this in novels before, the novels of Glenn David Gould, Catterbeats the Devil and stuff, where he's writing in a particular period where you feel that this period is now.
Yeah.
You feel at the end of Catterbeats the Devil and television comes in, and you're like, wow. Mm-hmm. Television, that sounds interesting, because you're so immersed in that period. And I thought the way this has been realised is like you belong there, you know, you are in 1920s Weimar Germany. Mm-hmm. And you feel like you could kind of walk around in a virtual reality set and you'd be in the streets and everything.
I mean, it is the bringing together of everything that I've suspected for a while that television has directed itself so much towards verisimilitude. This has got to look like we really are north of the wall, or we really are in 1890s London, that you're sort of immersing yourself in tableau rather than characters. And this has got the characters to go with it.
Yeah.
You know, it makes you feel that, you know, we tend to look back on these periods in time as, you know, slightly amusing, possibly because we see 1920s Germany in accelerated black and white, which makes it naturally comical, and we tend to think of it as an unserious period. And
watching, or as in cabaret, or
we tend to think of it as about camp and cliche and so forth. Mm. And this makes it very clear that whatever time you're alive is the most serious time. And you really are in amongst this kind of this plot and these gangsters and this wealth of characters. It is multi-layered, isn't it? Because we, as well as the crime timeline, we have these Trotskyists. Yeah. And there's gangsters, and there's the hint of political corruption higher up, and you get the sense that this is going to be Das Wire, and it's going to unfurl.
Bizarrely, just before I watched that, I had been trudging along The Wire again, because it appeared on Now TV, so I decided to rewatch it. So I was actually, I found myself finding loads of similarities between them. So, because it drops you in without explaining anything. And I really like that. And I think that's what David Simon does as well. He just drops you in and never really sets up what the story is.
The best stories feel like they've been going on for a while and you've got to catch up. What do we make of the leads? There's the vice cop, Rath, and there's lots of the working girl of spirit and talent, and we're not quite sure what she does. And then we start to discover what she does.
I think he's intriguing because, you know, it's a great start with him being sort of taken back through hypnotic regression to the source of his chronic anxiety or whatever. So that for me makes the whole thing feel like you're seeing it through the prism of his sort of PTSD.
Yeah,
and
that's a classic film noir thing as well, isn't it?
Yeah,
the detective with a skeleton in the back of the cupboard.
Yeah, the secret that you can't. Yeah. I love the way that the only way he can cure his kind of shakes, his trembles, is by drinking, I presume, it's kind of liquid cocaine or something. But he's constantly nipping into the lavvy to kind of break open another vial of this stuff. And his co-coppers are going like, have you got the shits again?
And Liv Lisa Fries as Lotta, she has the most extraordinary face. She's absolutely beautiful. But the performance for me is fantastic because she's just another face in the crowd. But every face in the crowd is the star of their own incredibly intense story. Linda, what did you make of her as a...
I just thought she was absolutely brilliant and I really believed her as being of that time. I think she really captured the time. I think they've done a really good job in the mise-en-scène as well, and sort of really capturing the period. I mean, there are a couple of sequences when they're outside where you could see that it was a little bit modern Germany.
There was a really good bit with when the policeman goes to a bar and there's a kind of people dancing to jazz in you know, in the interior, and it's great, and he kind of gets involved in the dancing scene, and that's brilliant. There's one where she's on a tram and it's an aerial scene and it's this massive square which is kind of like, you thought, okay, it's a really good computer-generated kind of view, but it was obviously way too much to put another kind of 200 computer-generated people walking through it. So it looks kind of like empty. And,
You know what, though? I thought about that because a lot of the street scenes feel rather empty. And I think that's actually probably more accurate than we might think because there weren't cars in those days and there weren't kind of, you know, cities were not as densely populated as they are now. You look back at, I mean, I tend to nose around through old pictures of Liverpool and old pictures of London because I'm boring like that, and you see how empty streets were.
Yeah, but you also see those pictures of kind of Brick Lane Market or Petticoat Lane and they're rammed.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
I mean, there are, you know, I thought that I liked the kind of close-up scenes where you had the Jews,
the Ashkenazis
wandering around with the big fur hats and stuff, and I thought that was a really good touch, and you suddenly go like, oh right, yeah, they won't be there in kind of 20 years.
I was intrigued enough to go back and do a little bit of reading around it, and because I'm definitely hooked and following this through now, and it's based on a series of eight novels,
right?
And the guy who's written the I think it's not a spoiler to say that the whole point is you're watching the rise of Nazism, you know, in the background of all the stuff we've been talking about, and
you mean the Nazis take over Germany,
spoiler,
and it finishes in the books aren't all finished yet, but the plan is it finishes in 1938 when war's inevitable, but he's got such an obsession, the author of the books has got such an obsessive kind of relationship with getting the detail right. Yeah. If he sets a scene on the night of the 28th of October 1929, he goes back and finds out what the weather was like on that night. You know, every single detail for him is it just kind of fully realised.
I was sort of Googling on my iPad on my knee while I was watching this, and Rath, the cop, has come from Cologne. And we learned it's something to do with Adenauer. And I looked it up. Adenauer really was in charge of it. He was the mayor of Cologne at the time. And Adenauer's career runs through the Second World War and into democratic Germany later. And I hope we're going to discover a lot more about this. Obviously, the Trotskyists, they're on the way to Istanbul. Trotsky really was in Istanbul. I'm sure, I mean, we as British people watching this are not getting a tenth of what the German viewership will be getting from this. I also really like the fact that because it's a German co-production, you don't recognise any of the faces. You don't go, oh, why, he was in Game of Thrones. Oh, look, it's, you know, it's a third cop on the left in
Life on Mars. It makes it more believable if you don't know who they are. I do think some of the introductions, like the introduction of the sort of the Trotskyists, was a bit facile. I just thought, oh, God, here we go, you know. Sort of, you know.
They're at their printing press again.
I just thought that was a little bit...
But that wasn't a cliche then. Yeah. It's a cliche now.
I know.
Trotsky out in a room, all they're going to do is produce a Samizdat newspaper.
Yeah, that's what you did then.
Long live
comrades, Trotsky. And to make their own entertainment.
It's like we're coming up to the annual Boxer Delights rerun in my house. And they're up to Christmas. And Boxer Delights ends, again, 30-year-old spoilers, 60-year-old book. You know, at the end of that, he wakes up and it was all a dream. Mm. And you watch it now and you go, that's so lame. But when he wrote the book, he was the first person ever to use that as a plot device.
There you go.
So it was like, oh my God, that's amazing. So it's a similar... Like...
Did you see the jazz rave in episode 2?
No, I've only watched one.
It's incredible. It is fantastic. It's all the kind of Fritz Lang feel, the kind of cabaret bit.
Yeah.
There is a huge musical set piece, which is... around which happen a whole load of the kind of plot triggers. Because I think a lot of the first episode, quite rightly, as it is often the case with these big shows, is kind of scene setting and throat clearing, and it really kicks off in the second one. But the jazz rave, honestly, it's one of the best things I've seen on television.
You mentioned Fritz Lang. I was going to mention the first episode very much looked like, you know, the outside bits very much looked like M. You know, when you're you're setting the scene in M. It was very Fritz Lang-y, definitely.
Well, I was watching the trailers and humming Dr. Mabuse by Propaganda to myself, because it's all part of the same thing. I mean, the City is the star, isn't it? And you're right, there's a huge dramatic irony in looking at this and going, this is all going to go.
Yeah.
Can we just point out that if you're going to sit down and watch it with your... don't watch it with your Methodist chapel attending granny. The opening scene is not going to make anybody who's of a Christian...
I would suggest don't let your Methodist granny watch the second one either, because she'll disapprove, I think. She'll say, this Nazism thing is no good whatsoever. I think we should put a stop to it, is what she'll say. Right then... I love this. I'm going to follow it to the bitter end. I'll watch 10 series of this.
Absolutely.
Okay, me too.
Excellent. Let's get back to now and Pete Brown's choice of music. Pete, what have you brought in for us?
Track from what is turning into one of my favourite albums of the year. Mm-hmm. A new discovery for me, Kelly Lee Owens, who mm-hmm. was a producer, young woman from North Wales, and just made her debut album. And this track is Throwing Lines.
Yes, well, funnily enough, Jude Rogers, friend of the podcast, she also chose Kelly Lee Owens a couple of weeks ago, so clearly
It's happening.
Here we go, openly Welsh, it's Kelly Lee Owens with Throwing Lines. Kelly Lee Owens and Throwing Lines, as selected by Pete Brown. Pete, how did you invent Kelly Lee Owens?
It was one of those lovely things that you, every time you go to a festival, you pray this is going to happen, and sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't. And I was at the end of the road in September, and I found myself at a loose end between acts that I wanted to see. And I was walking past a big marquee, and I heard this sound like that coming out. And I thought it was background music between acts, because it is quite mellow, a lot of it. And I walked in and there's this tiny little woman on stage surrounded by banks of keyboards and laptops. And there was about 100 people at the front, just kind of nodding along. And I thought, this is a nice sound. I'll wait here for a bit. And then the album is very mellow. A lot of people say it's a very aqueous album. It sounds like it's coming from underwater and far away and stuff. And very gradually she notched it up and the beats came in. And by the end of the set, the tent was full of people just absolutely banging their nuts. It was just fantastic. And it was just a beautiful kind of like, I've made a new discovery and she's brilliant. And excellent. I want it to be huge.
What kind of beer would she be?
I'm
not letting this go.
You know, you don't have to. That's quite an easy one. She would be Camel Valley Pilsner.
Okay.
Which is a very elegant lager brewed with champagne yeast and then gone through the whole champagne maturation method. And so it comes out somewhere between a very fine pilsner and champagne, and it's beautiful and it's delicate and it's light and sophisticated.
Is it from Cornwall, being
yes.
Camel Valley?
Yes, it's a collaboration between Sharps Brewery and Camel Valley Winery. Oh.
Has anybody ever made something called Harper Valley IPA? And if they haven't, why haven't they? We'll make a note of that. We'll do that.
Right.
Okay, careful. Fair dues. All right, in sharp contrast, Everything gets its 40th birthday reissue now. This week it's the turn of Critics Darling's Queen and News of the World. Sir Frederick of Lucan and Friends managed to progress from much lampoon prog rock through much lampoon stadium rock to much lampoon disco and radio pop, with only their billions and billions in record sales to console them. How did they find the strength to go on? Absence, however, has made the heart grow fonder, especially with dear Sir Fred, who now seems like an heroic and lovable figure rather than the butt of music press jokes. News of the World was their grand step into arena rock before there was arena rock. It's the one with We Will Rock You and We Are the Champions on it, and it's out now in a gigantic edition including something called The Raw Sessions, a new alternate version of the album created in 2017 from demos and alternate mixes. Is that strictly kosher, and how does it all sound after 40 years? We're going to talk about it after this from the album. This is Spread Your Wings. Yes, Queen. Queen with Spread Your Wings from News of the World. Linda Marrick, were you a Queen head at all?
Not really. I can't say that I've ever been a big fan. I know lots of their songs and will happily sing along to them. And I liked Freddie as a person because I thought he was outrageous and pissed off at loads of people.
Yeah.
It's sort of conservative UK. I like his songs. I like their songs. Yeah. I wouldn't say I was a massive fan, no.
I think when you're kind of in our age group, you're kind of forbidden from liking Queen, aren't you? I remember The Fall having anti the group Queen sound written on one sleeve.
Oh, God. I don't have any of those problems with them. I think they're a good band and they sound great and they're stadium band. They don't say anything to me about who
I am. They say nothing to you about your life.
Exactly.
Mm. Pete, did Queen say anything to you about your life?
They said a lot of grim things. I actually got beaten up for not liking Queen.
Well, you are from Barnsley.
Yeah, when I was growing up in Barnsley, initially it was like you were a mod or a rocker, that was it, in the mod revival of 1979, and rocker transmuted into heavy metal. And then the heavy metal thing stayed, and mod disappeared, but indie took its place. And the metalers were definitely in the majority in my school, in my friendship groups, everywhere. And so while I was in my bedroom listening to Smiths, everyone else was listening to Queen. And there was always that kind of like, almost like the darkness. It was like, is this a pastiche or are they a real rock band? You know, because you can tell they're playing at it and there's a bit
of
dilettantish. I don't know. I think there's a thing which can be sincere and at the same time be dilettantish.
I think you're being really generous because I don't think they're playing at it. I think it's cold-eyed calculation. I don't think there's any kind of, you know, they're never, there is not, I've looked carefully when we decided to do this, and I looked carefully within myself, and there is not one iota of my body that thinks that Queen are a good thing in any way, shape, or form.
The only thing that fascinates me, I watched a documentary about the making of this album, and I've always been quite intrigued by Roger Taylor, as, you know, in a band with Freddie Mercury, he's never going to get much airtime. Yeah. But he struck me on the documentary about when they're making this album that he would have been a pop or rock star in any period. I could see Roger Taylor being in the Manic Street Preachers. Or I could see him being in
Manic Street Preachers, would love that.
Or I could see him being in the Small Faces. It's like, whichever period he was born in, he was going to be this influential musical figure. So I think he's very interesting.
Yeah.
But it's just that bloody sound. It's the effects that Brian May puts on his guitars.
Yeah.
That kind of, like he's playing it in a toilet roll holder or something. That just straight takes me back to Barnsley in the early 80s and being forced at gunpoint to listen to this album.
Is it possible to listen to this stuff outside of those contexts then? Because, I mean, I had never listened to this record before and I could not bear to listen to We Are the Champions or We Will Rock You. I had to go straight to track three. Yeah. I simply cannot bear those songs. I've been hammered into my head. But when I listen to the rest of it, you know, look, I don't like Queen, but these were good Queen songs.
Mm-hmm.
And particularly, they're interesting things like Sheer Heart Attack, which is their attempt to do punk.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Which is so... it's like they've sort of understood it and sort of haven't, because it's so incredibly basic, but also somehow overproduced as
that
well.
That is a Pistols riff, isn't it? That is totally a Pistols riff.
But that for me, just says to me that they're not real, because why try to do something that's not you? I think it's because they were being hammered by 77.
Also, if you read about this album, they decided to kind of simplify it. So they actually made a conscious decision, which is, you know, which is great, but I don't think it's for artistic reasons.
Yeah, it's
just like, let's sell more records by being really cynical in terms of what we're going to do.
I sort of don't mind that, as long as it sounds excited and interesting. And the problem with this for me is that it's so kind of, you know, it is the cliche before the cliche. You know, it is the cliche of mega rock before the cliche had been invented. And I realise I'm being a total hypocrite there, having just defended the portrayal of Trotskyists in Babylon Berlin. But to me, it's like being offered, it's like being offered a bottle of Budweiser. There you go. In fact, here we go, Pete. What beer is near Queen?
Newcastle Brown.
Newcastle Brown, obviously. Yeah. Why did I even need to ask? Mojo wants to describe Queen as rock music for 12-year-olds, which makes it actually quite attractive, really, because the 12-year-old in me would probably be quite excited about that. Were there any things on this that we liked?
Honestly, no. Personally, I hummed along to loads of it because I kind of knew the tunes, but I really, in all honesty, it didn't really excite me in any way. Like Matt was saying, I looked inside me and found nothing that I liked about it. So.
Yeah, all it's got going for it is enormous success. I mean, I'm going to say, I did think there are some things in here that I was surprised and impressed by, the kind of weird radiophonic noises at the end of Sheer Heart Attack. All Dead is weirdly touching. Sir Fred at his piano, and it's kind of hard not to see it kind of prefiguring that. I think, you know, I dug into this to try and find out what it's about. Apparently, it's about Brian May's cat.
So
it's very heartfelt. I miss you so much.
The tragedy that he's felt at that point.
But
in his life.
You know, I understand that. You know, but then he's got things like "Get Down, Make Love," which is utterly unlistenable.
Oh, there's some hilarious lyrics in that, though.
Yeah,
yeah. I'll give you my buck teeth. You give me whatever. And it's, I liked "My Melancholy Blues" because it's just Freddie being a showman, and you realise when you look at it all in context, from Bohemian Rhapsody to Barcelona, that he just wants to be a big showman. And rock in its 1970s form provided an outlet for that.
He's the appealing side of it. The documentary that comes with it, I mean, I've got to say, it is the most boring thing I've ever watched. Really, really dull. This was kind of shot with Whispering Bob Harris around the time 1977, and for some reason it didn't come out. Now we know why it didn't come out. It's immensely dull, because the band have got nothing to say apart from "we want to get bigger," and Whispering Bob can't ask a question. I mean, there are questions, how's the light show coming together, and are you satisfied? It's like watching an interview with the Chancellor of the Exchequer in 1952. Have you any plans for the economy? Yes, we have great plans for the economy. Thank you for your time, sir.
Yes.
But there is one, it is like Spinal Tap without the jokes. There's one unintentionally funny bit where they're discussing the set list, and somebody, I think it's Roger Taylor, says, well, there's no point in saying "We Will Rock You" after we've already rocked them.
Yes.
Which I thought was quite funny. It is Alan Partridge Gold.
What's wrong with being sexy?
But in the middle of it, and actually slightly buried in the documentary, is Freddie, who is a bigger character than the documentary.
Yeah.
And I sort of think, you know, you see him in his American Princess t-shirt. How did the world not know? I mean, there's the truth about Dear Sir Fred.
This is what you were saying, Linda. I mean, those guys who forced me to listen to Queen and beat me up when I didn't like them were massively homophobic.
Yeah.
And had no idea that Freddie was gay. Not a clue until he died. And then their reaction was, oh, well, I guess if Freddie was gay, it must be all right then. And so
well, that's progress.
It changed their attitudes towards homosexuality.
Was it okay as long as you were the lead singer of Queen? But if you found one Town Centre,
I think it was a fairly fundamental change. I've got friends who teach in Barnsley now, and you've got gay kids coming out at sort of 12, 13, 14, and the rest of the class goes, "All right, mate." And it's totally acceptable in the way that some of the other prejudices that I grew up with are still very strong there, like racial prejudices and stuff. The prejudice of homosexuality has just disappeared, and I think Freddie played a not insignificant part in that.
There's one other bit in the documentary I have to make a note of, where this is amongst the many things that make it quite a dull watch, are the fact that it's fully controlled by the Queen image machine, which is now it's now Brian and Roger. And there's one bit where, again, I couldn't hear exactly who's saying it, but somebody says, "Well, there wasn't much sex and drugs on this tour." Yes. Oh yeah, really? And can you see Sir Fred going to bed with a cup of Ovaltine and a Bell Bainbridge? I can't.
There wasn't much sex and drugs on this tour, but we're just popping over to Ibiza, where we're going to have dwarves walking around with plates of cocaine on their heads.
Absolutely. I thought there were one or two good bits on the extras. I mean, obviously the extras is purely fan stuff, but there is some interesting stuff on it, particularly the fast rock version of "We Will Rock You" that sounds like Queens of the Stone Age, and which is actually quite exciting. You know, it's, you know, rather than that done to death sort of studio chant.
Still, I'd rather listen to Queens of Stone Age in that case.
Well,
you know what I mean?
What do we think Sir Fred would be doing now? if he'd survived.
Oh, he'd probably be a boring old Tory, probably. I mean, I don't know. They all turn out.
He'd be Elton John.
Yeah.
I like to think that Sir Fred would have embraced his destiny, and he would have, like, in the mid-noughties, he would have done a record with the Scissor Sisters, and he would have done a record with Seth Troxler or John Grant. He would have, because now that gay pop and dance music is the engine room.
Yeah.
I'd like to think, in my alternate future, where Sir Fred was all right, he'd now be the caffeinated Elton John. He'd now be the Elton John, you know, Brain Force Plus, wouldn't he? He'd be ultra Elton John.
I think you're right.
Still making bangers. R.I.P. Sir Fred. Well, I like to think that he would have stuck with the disco, so here comes a segue. we're going to talk about the 40th anniversary edition of Saturday Night Fever, which gave men permission to dance like strutting peacocks and sing in high voices. The soundtrack is out again in a brand new edition. Any excuse. This, is, of course, Walter Murphy with the Fifth of Beethoven. That's a bit more like it. Walter Murphy with a Fifth of Beethoven. Pop fact, this was originally credited to Walter Murphy and the Big Apple Band, but it turned out there was another Big Apple Band who had to later change their name to Chic. Astonishing. I didn't know this at all. Linda Marrick, please explain why Saturday Night Fever was a watershed in Western culture whose consequences we are still wrestling with.
I mean, wow, that's a big question. Really, I mean, being a film critic, I can only talk about the film itself rather than I absolutely love the soundtrack, obviously, but I think the film is one of the greatest movies ever made. Especially, it's subversive, it has social issues in it. Lots of people think of it as just being this kind of like a dancey film, but it isn't, you know. It's a very heavy subject, you know. Features the C word in it, you know, several times.
Well, there's a rape scene as well, which would be a difficult sell now. Definitely.
It's absolutely brilliantly made. Travolta is brilliant in it, obviously. I think there isn't really much else I can add to it, really. I just think it's not just off its time. And I think the film is being re-released as well.
Yes, the whole thing is by the BFI.
And I think go see it. See it on a big screen, because it is really worth seeing it.
Well, to me, I mean, this is post-rationalisation. Obviously, I'm 10 years old. I'm not thinking about this. I'm just going, look, he's doing disco dancing. But you realise it's about masculinity, and it's about a new way to be a man, that you can almost resurrect the kind of Beau Brummel thing of looking beautiful and looking amazing, and
you can dress sharply and still be macho.
And it's still quite stunning. That scene where Travolta's walking down the street, just completely full of himself, is electrifying. Mm-hmm. Pete, you a fan?
I missed the point entirely of disco. I mean, like I said, I was 9 years old when it came out, but it was so ubiquitous. And again, I felt oppressed by it, just as I did by Queen. And listening back to it now, it reminds me of just this feeling of this is, like I said, I completely missed the point, because it was like, oh, this is all this kind of huge sweeping strings and New York glamour, and it's got nothing to say to me about my life. And
that's the way I always think of Barnsley, though. Strings and glamour of Barnsley.
And what I missed, and I've never been a dancer. My wife won't allow me to dance. She said it gives her the fear. My movements are not to be seen by other people. And of course, the whole point of it is, when you get out on the dance floor, it doesn't matter who you are. People from backgrounds like mine, that is when nothing else matters. Everything else falls away, and you're there. So I understand it intellectually. Actually, and I've got a huge amount of fondness for that, but I just
it
doesn't speak to me.
I mean, it was kind of it's interesting, isn't it, how the music divorced from the film, and how the film is so based around kind of Nick Cohen's tribal rights of New Saturday Night, and is really gritty, and I think in the States it's got a slightly different there's a slightly different remembering of the film, because people are aware that that kind of Italian stallion, the Italian kind of really macho culture that he comes out of.
There was this term at the time, it used to appear on the front of Rolling Stone, sweat hog. John Travolta is a sweat hog.
Yeah, and the bits where he's working in his dead end job in the paint shop, and he's walking down the street, and the bits where he's on the subway in his white suit, and it's all kind of graffiti and stuff, and then I think because a lot of people couldn't see the film, our age couldn't see the film because it was it an 18?
It was an 18, yeah, because there's sexual violence.
So all they saw
adult
was
situations.
The Bee Gees on top of the Pops and Kenny Everett taking the piss.
Yeah.
Yes.
Mm.
And then, so it became a thing of silliness rather than the soundtrack to this really gritty movie.
But when you listen to the music in isolation, the silliness kind of... I think that's purely in context, because you listen to it now and, you know, and pretty much ever since, really. It is incredible music, incredible songwriting. 50% of the album is written by the Bee Gees, mm-hmm. including stuff they don't perform. Like
but then
More
the ones,
Than a Woman, it says.
More Than a Woman.
Said, yeah.
But then, you know, there are other tracks that they don't perform, like Yvonne Elliman's If I Can't Have You. Is Disco Inferno on there as well,
yeah,
by the Tramps? You know, really great tunes.
Great. Mm. Really,
and it was for a time the largest selling album ever, wasn't it? Or something? Mm. I think it came out just as modern statistics were about to be compiled. You know,
yeah, I mean, if we're talking about the film as well, I also think the treatment of women in it is not excused. I think it actually does a really good job in showing how women were treated in that kind of sort of environment. It doesn't say it's okay to do it, and I think it does make a kind of a feminist point as well.
Because you're sort of kind of showing a traditional Italian family culture is treats women badly, and supposedly this thing that they're escaping from and breaking out into, the boys are escaping into a new world.
Yeah.
Turns out they're going to treat women just as badly
in that
new world.
Yeah.
I think it's fantastically subtle and well put together. I mean, it did kind of freeze the Bee Gees in aspect as those amusing disco guys, when in fact they are among the greatest songwriters of all time. This thing is coming out in an insane box set with like your obligatory 180 GSM double vinyl and a Blu-ray DVD and all the rest of it. Some slightly pointless remixes of the four key Bee Gees tracks. You know, I don't understand.
There was a bit of sort of modernish techno in the intro, and then it was pretty much the same.
Yeah.
It's a slightly heavier beat.
It's like putting a fidget spinner in the Mona Lisa's hand. It doesn't make any sense at all. So there you go. You can try to understand the New York Times and Ed McMahon, which is what my missus always thought the lyric was. So we're running out of time. And at the end of the show means closing time chatter, where our guests tell us what they'll be talking about when last orders ring out at the pop-up artisan brown ale shop near you. Pete Brown, what's your closing time chatter?
There seems to be a slut. There seems to be a glut at the moment of headlines that could have been written by Chris Morris.
Yes.
And on Brass Eye. And my favourite one this week is Donald Trump face found in Jarrow dog's ear.
Yes, I saw this. It's remarkable.
Which is just wonderful. So you've got this beagle owned by Jade Robinson, 25, of Jarrow Tyneside. And because the beagle's ears trail along the ground a lot, they get quite a lot of dirt in them. And this poor dog's got a cyst in its ear that needs to go to the vet. They had to put the dog to sleep. Not sorry.
Oh
my
keep
word.
It light, Pete. It's a light-hearted show.
They had to wait until the dog was asleep to kind of look at the cyst and take a photograph of it, which they did. It took it in close-up. And then the dog owner's friend looked at it and said, that is Donald Trump. And I've got a picture here. And this dog's ear, complete with massive blonde quiff, Donald Trump's face is in this dog's ear. And I think it's not quite onomatopoeia, but it's the same thing. You know, you see Jesus's face on a slice of toast or whatever. Donald Trump's face, it's entirely fitting that it's being picked
in a dirty
out by
old dog's ear.
Assist in a dog's ear. It's just fitting in
it
a way
is,
that
it?
His face on a piece of toast wouldn't be.
Yeah, I mean, I just wonder how she discovered that. You know, sort of like, you know, her friends are folding the ear back and going, they don't look like anything at all to you.
Yeah. it was apparently when they were looking at the photos which they'd taken for the vet.
Yeah.
And her friend looked at the photo and said, look, there's Donald Trump.
Is it totally the best dog's ear there's ever been? And there's never been a dog's ear anywhere near as good as this.
Yeah, it's such a great dog's ear.
It's the best dog's ear. Fantastic. Linda, closing time chatter, what have you got for us?
I mean, the only thing I want to say is go and watch Call Me By Your Name.
Right.
Because it really needs people to go and see it. And I just think more encouragement to go and see Paddington 2, which is one of the greatest children's movie ever made.
Yes.
And, that's it, really.
Okay. Okay.
Right.
Matt Hall, what have you got?
Oh, and Killing of Sacred Deer, obviously.
Yes.
Yeah, please.
I'd just like to say that a friend of the show and forthcoming guest presenter, Laura Barton, is doing a series on Radio 4 at the moment. A series of, I think it's three, and the second one's just gone out, the third one goes out on Monday, and it's available on the iPlayer Radio website. And it's called The Confidence Trick, and it's about confidence in public life and how it affects people's life choices. And she was talking to some ridiculously confident people, and Laura's rather brilliant, kind of very quiet interview style You just feel her eyebrow is ever so slightly raised when she talks to people. And then the second one, she goes to Manchester Grammar and talks to kids there who are obviously kind of very imbued with confidence, and then kids from the kind of the comprehensive just down the road. And it's just a really nice, quiet series, and I would recommend it.
Okay, that's on the iPlayer now, the confidence trick.
Yeah.
Okay, well, my closing time chatter is R.I.P. Dudley Simpson. Who is Dudley Simpson? He did lots of the Doctor Who music between 1964 and 1980. He also did the music on The Tomorrow People and the theme from Blake 7, which is, you know, this is some of the most majestic TV music. You know, a prodigious talent. And this was when you had to get eeriness out of a bassoon and some timpani. You didn't have the mast. You didn't have a computer full of every single sound ever made. And you also had to do it to a BBC budget and a BBC timescale. And the stuff that he did is so utterly redolent of the time. You know, you watch some old Tom Baker Doctor Who's. That's where the eeriness comes from. It all comes from Dudley Simpson's mind. He was a bit hurt, really, because he got dumped off Doctor Who in 1980 when they decided on a kind of radical 80s revamp, changed the titles, changed the music, went with synths on everything. And that was a great phase as well. The people who are now touring the Radiophonic Workshop includes many of the people who did that sort of that reinvention of the sound. But Dudley Simpson was kind of, pushed to the sides. I think he was a bit hurt by it. But his stuff is definitely worn better than some of the later synth stuff. It has that grain of the time, and also that time when, although it was children's television, it didn't feel the need to patronise you. I think sometimes recently it's been, you know, the incidental music on Doctor Who has been very kind of finger pointy. Be sad now, be happy now, be scared now. And Dudley Simpson's world was a world of his own, and he made it to 95. So that's that's a good innings. R.I.P. Dudley Simpson.
To paraphrase Billy Connolly, you've got to say that the country wouldn't have the problems it currently has if the theme from Blake 7 was our national anthem.
Absolutely.
I think it would inspire us all to find a version of pride in our country that we're happy with and get on together.
Especially the bit at the end that goes, wow, exactly. Wow. And there's your show. Thank you to Linda Marrick for coming on the show. What are you going to go and see next?
I'm seeing Only the Brave and something called A Caribbean Dream. No idea.
All right, fair dues.
Not even looked at it.
Okay, that's it. And to beer guru Pete Brown, what are you up to next?
Oh, it's very exciting. This afternoon, I'm the chairman of judges for the annual Guild of Beer Writing Awards.
Oh, right.
So that's going to be a bit of a bun fest.
Okay, fair dues. And just finally, if this show was a beer, what kind of beer would it be? Some kind of bin end thing.
Oh, no, now you're talking about...
What beers use all the kind of sweepings up from the hot room floor?
I'm utterly stumped on that one.
Some IPA, maybe.
It's probably going to be some kind of supermarket generic thing with just beer on the front, like Pills album, isn't it?
Yeah. No, I'm going to say it would be. I'm going to be very kind and say it would be a Belgian Trappist, like Orval or something like that.
Oh,
because it perhaps gets overlooked in the modern hype of things, but always has something to return to, and you always discover something new in it. And whenever you stray off somewhere else, you come back to it, you go, yeah, this is the one.
And it also gives you a stinking hangover. Thank you for coming on the show, Linda and Pete. Remember, dearest listener, you can hear this episode of Big Mouth again and all of our past shows at audioboom.com/channel/Big Mouth. Perhaps you can listen again and drink each of those beers as Pete mentions
them. That would be a great idea.
It'd be a very, very good idea. We'll be back again next week. See you then. Bye-bye.